America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a call-in show, and our topic today is monetary freedom and its opposite. So please call in with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. That, again, is 1-800-313-9443. Folks, today we have an exciting show. First, we have our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell, with us today. Folks, we are introducing Zoe as one of our special commentators. Zoe is a recent graduate of Mises University. She has studied business economics and is the marketing manager for a firm outside of Houston, Texas. Zoe brings to us a practical integration of economic theory and practical business life. So, hello, Zoe.
Hi.
So, today our special guest is Dr. Mark Thornton. Welcome, Mark. Are you there? We've been having some technical difficulties getting Mark connected, so we're going to go ahead and check in on that in just a second. Folks, Mark is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, and for the past 25 years, Mark has been an acclaimed scholar and teacher of Austrian economics, which I like to call reality economics, because reality is not optional. And so, again, let me reiterate that this is a call-in show today, so call us with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. So now I'm going to ask our board operator, Ken, have you been able to get a hold of Dr. Thornton? Okay, not yet. All right, so, well, let me introduce this a little bit further. I was very impressed with an essay that Mark wrote recently called Monetary Freedom and Its Opposite, which is available, by the way, at Mises.org. Let me spell that for you. That's Mises.org. We have also posted it at our website, RadioFreeMarket.com. Look under our blog section, which is called The Free Market Voice. And I encourage all listeners to read this excellent short article. Again, the title is Monetary Freedom and Its Opposite. So, very good. Mark, are you with us now?
I sure am. It's great to be with you, Michael, today and your audience. Happy Halloween.
Yes, happy Halloween. Well, we're going to talk about some scary stuff. We're going to talk about monetary freedom. Well, I want to start off by reading a short quote from this article that you wrote that I just referred everybody to read, that's posted both on our website, radiofreemarket.com, and also where it originated at Mises.org. And the name again is Monetary Freedom and Its Opposite. And in this article, Mark, you write, "The only true path to reform is monetary freedom. We have gone from a situation where money was entirely free from government intervention to one that is completely dominated by government." Now, most people don't have any knowledge of this history of money. Can you start us off with an ABC education of what is money and how it evolved?
Absolutely. And, you know, you need to know what money is and where it came from in order to understand things like why the price of gold is over $1,000 and why we have stock market crashes and so on.
Okay.
And to get to the meat of the issue, we have to go back in time to primitive society and imagine what life was like without money.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have something to make exchanges, to facilitate exchanges. And, of course, you have very primitive conditions, subsistence levels of living. But as society develops and becomes more progressive, more complicated, making trades between individuals and tribes of individuals becomes more difficult. And so they start to look for something that will facilitate exchanges.
Okay. Well, you know, it's funny, these segments are fairly short, so we're going to have to come back after the break. We're going to pick up where we left off. We have Dr. Mark Thornton. This is Radio Free Market, and your host, Michael McKay. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Be right back. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and today we have Dr. Mark Thornton, and we're going to be talking about monetary freedom and its opposite. But We were just getting started, and I asked you, Mark, could you give us a brief overview of what is money and how did it evolve?
Absolutely, and we begin with a primitive society where they don't have money, and you can imagine how difficult it is to make trades between individuals. Just as today, as an economist, if I went to the grocery store and said, I want these groceries and I'll be willing to give you a lecture in economics, you know, that's just not going to go very far. And so you need that medium of exchange. And early, a couple thousand years ago, they discovered that certain products people were willing to accept, especially things like salt and hides and things of that nature, because people could turn around and resell them for other goods and services.
Yeah.
Or use them themselves, yes.
So when did you humans start to use paper money?
Well, paper money basically becomes prevalent about 250 years ago. It was also used earlier in China, but it's more of a recent phenomenon. And basically you have, commodities like salt and leather, tobacco and so forth being gradually replaced by metals such as copper, such as gold and silver, which were more or less permanent, were small, were easy to carry. And eventually, some entrepreneurs came up with the idea of coining these metals into coins of equal weight and equal purity. They would put their mark on that, and those coins started dominating money in Europe and around the Mediterranean, Greek civilization, Roman civilization, Western civilization. And at that point, you start to see the introduction of paper money. First, it's done by bankers who are trying to facilitate the movement of money from one country to another or from one region to another. It's a lot easier to carry a piece of paper and cash it in at a different bank, and not having to carry all the gold and silver, which might be stolen from you. And so banknotes are a market innovation. But then eventually, of course, government wants to take over all of this. And so they start taking over the minting of coins, and they start taking over the printing of paper dollars or paper money several hundred years ago. But this is where, of course, you get the trick-or-treat part. You know, you think, well, this is an innovation on the part of government. It's easy to carry around these paper bills. But ultimately, of course, what we find out in every instance is that it's not a treat, it's a trick, and that the government debases the value or reduces the value of those paper, that paper money.
Now, people are starting to wake up about understanding money, and that's been a key point about our show, is to try to give people these fundamental ABCs about money and how it works. Is fiat money the same thing as paper money?
Yes, it is. Fiat money is money by law, money that you are required to use by the government for paying your taxes, paying your debts, and things of that nature. So fiat money is something that the government has declared as money, whereas when you talk about the original bankers who were creating banknotes, those were paper warehouse receipts for gold and silver.
Okay.
And so you couldn't really change, the bankers couldn't change the contract. They couldn't reduce the amount of gold that those banknotes represented. Whereas with fiat money, there's nothing really backing it. It's just required by law.
And so this is the opposite of market money.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Market money is on a contractual basis. It's based on property. It's based on contract. And, you know, the paper bills or the paper notes actually specified what they represented, you know, that this bill represented 1 ounce of gold or this bill represented 10 ounces of silver. And all of our, you know, all of our monetary units around the world, the dollar, the pound, the lira, the franc, those original terms all specified a weight of gold or silver.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, if you look at the Federal Reserve note, there's no specified value. There's no redeeming value. It's completely arbitrary. And, of course, it's largely a function of how many paper dollar bills those central banks and those governments are printing up. And, again, this is where the trick comes in.
Right. And this has become the equation of fiat money commonly now people talk about fiat money as being worthless paper. You know, we want to talk more about that, and we also want to get to the topic of banking. But we have a caller that has called in, Paul from Delaware. And so, Paul, are you on the line there? I think we have Paul from Delaware that's been trying to get on with us. I'm not sure that he's still on the line. Okay.
Yes, sir, I am.
Oh, good. Did you have a question?
Yes, I sure did. I'd like to thank the good doc for giving us some of his time today and all the hard work he's put in, and the fact that he cares to actually try to hold people's hands and to help them learn about stuff that they should have learned in school. But I'm enjoying listening to you, and right now, I guess the only thing I wanted to comment about something else, and so I will talk about what I wanted to real quick, and then I just wanted to make a point. But more importantly, sir, I'm enjoying your conversation, and I would just like to say, as you're speaking about that, could you do us a favor and stop saying government, the evil government is the one responsible, because government is a soulless entity. There are human beings. There's human beings right now manipulating the system. And so as you're speaking about this, could you give us some names of these individuals who are behind the conspiracy? And that's exactly what it is, a conspiracy to manipulate and steal from the American people. And that's pretty much all I had to say.
Well, thank you very much for your comments, Paul. We'll be getting back to some of those topics as we go forward. My initial comment that I would make about that is that government is a representative of the consciousness of the individuals on one level. On another level, it is a composition of a bunch of individuals that are actually in action. And they are, these individuals that are in this composition of action are actually taking advantage of one unique facet that no other human being is really allowed to have. They're given the legal superior authority of the use of force. And we grant that to this particular composition of people that we call government, and they utilize that. And that is a fundamental problem in our in the construct of how we operate. So we're not going to actually equate the word evil with that at this particular moment. We just want to make sure that that's what we're talking about. Mark, did you have a further clarification or comment
yes,
about
Michael,
what I just said?
Yeah, Michael, that was very well put. I would point out, however, is that some of these issues that we're talking about here are not taught in school. These are things that are clearly not brought to the attention of young people, of students. You know, they're not getting much economics education, and most of what they're getting is representative of the state and the people who operate the state. And certainly one of the things that we're going to get to here is that the current situation of central banking with fiat money places certain individuals at a tremendous advantage and the rest of us at a tremendous disadvantage. So that really is one of the things that we're going to be getting to here today.
Right. Well, let's talk about banking. When was the first central bank formed? And what was the story about that?
Well, there were early central banks in Venice and in Amsterdam, which were city-states. And those were not typical of what you have as a central bank today. The first real central bank is the Bank of London, which goes on to become the Bank of England. And it got started, its special privilege got started in the 17th century, at the end of the 17th century, when it basically agreed to take on a lot of government debt, and in exchange for special privileges, such as not having to redeem their paper banknotes for gold and silver at certain points in time. So, you know, what a bank fears the most is that if it emits these banknotes or this paper money privately, that all of these notes will come back at one time, and they won't have enough gold and silver coins to redeem them. So in order to get this privileged status, this public-private partnership sort of thing, they agreed to soak up a lot of England's government debt in order to gain this this special privilege. And really, central banking has not changed fundamentally since then.
Let me ask you this, by contrast, let's talk about free banking for just a second,
sure.
And I don't want to go too deeply into this topic, but, you know, what would free banking, by contrast, look like?
Well, free banking is nothing more than individuals taking in deposits and making loans, issuing bonds and making loans. Today they might take in certificates of deposits and make loans, but they would all be, you know, with free banking, there's competition between banks. So if one bank issued too much paper, that may all come back and be redeemed at one time and put pressure on the bank or maybe even bankrupt the bank. So that there's
they have to be very prudent in how they manage their affairs.
That's exactly right. They have competitive pressures,
right.
Both from their depositors as well as their competitors.
Have we ever had anywhere free banking?
Well, in the United States, in the first half of the 19th century, I think is probably what approximates free banking the best. And
okay.
Banks had high capital ratios.
All right, we're going to have to interrupt you right here, Mark. I'm sorry. But we are going to come back to this topic right after the break. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And please stay with us. We're going to be back just in a couple of minutes. We're going to continue this conversation on monetary freedom and its opposite. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we have today Dr. Mark Thornton. And over the break, our special commentator, Zoe, she was going to ask a question of Dr. Thornton.
Well, Dr. Thornton, why do you think that banking has always been controlled by a central government? Why do they always target the monetary system or the actual money of the economy?
Well, we've had 2,000 years of government meddling in money. We've had 300 years of government meddling in banking. And in the United States, since the Civil War, the federal government has been in charge. And the simple reason is that's where the money is. They make money off of the system while at the same time hurting the economy and the individuals within that system.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to switch gears here. I think this is enough of a history overview for the moment. I want to read another segment from your excellent article, Monetary Freedom and Its Opposite, which again is available on our website, radiofreemarket.com, and also Mises.org. I'm going to quote you right now, Mark. We are now at a point in time when the U.S. government is bankrupt. It cannot pay its bills. It cannot pay off its debt. It has future unfunded liabilities with a current value in excess of $60 trillion. And that was before all the current bailout packages. And I want to add to your quote, and we have a $1.4 trillion deficit in 2009. So, Mark, what do you conclude from this? What's going to happen next?
Well, the only thing I conclude is that either they are planning to go into a hyperinflation to pay off this mess, or that they are collectively dumb as a sack of horse manure. I mean, there's really no two alternatives. It's either hyperinflation or these guys are just plain stupid. And I think they're manipulating it intentionally and that we are headed towards hyperinflation.
Mm-hmm. So, Zoe, you were going to make a comment about that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder what happens when the dollar loses its power. I mean, does that mean that the government has less power, or are they just going, I mean, how can they control the economy further when their lifeblood sort of runs out?
Well, in hyperinflation, they're basically running the economy into the ground. Hyperinflation mm-hmm. means ever-increasing rates of inflation. We have rates of inflation like 10%. Mm-hmm. In a hyperinflation, it goes to hundreds of percent and thousands of percent. In Zimbabwe right now, people are exchanging bundles of billion-dollar Zimbabwe notes. The hyperinflation has gotten that bad.
In fact, I understand that the only way that they're operating right now is because there's a black market that is actually working in a less worse money, which is U.S. dollars.
That's right. And the South African rand as well.
Mm-hmm.
Two solid currencies that people are looking desperately for, because in a hyperinflation, everything breaks down. You can't hire labor. You can't pay your rent. You can't go shopping. You don't know what the prices of things are going to be. And it really degenerates. It's not just high prices. It's massive unemployment, social decay, moral decay, social unrest, violence, that's the direction that you head in when you head in the direction of hyperinflation. So it's
in terms of monetary reform, is this why you think that monetary freedom is of the utmost importance?
Absolutely. All the monetary reform we've had in the United States has only made things worse. It's only given government more power. And every time we do that, they get more power, we get less freedom, they get more of our money, we have less property rights over what we rightly deserve. And so that's the direction we've been going for a very long period of time, from a condition of gold and silver coins with competitive banking to a condition where the government controls the money supply, it controls interest rates, it's got a central Federal Reserve manipulating things, causing inflation, and causing the business cycle as well. And so we need to reverse that. We need to reverse that
so
and take power away from government.
Pardon me for interrupting you, but as a path to reform this, what are some of the basic steps that we need to take that, you know, can help our listeners understand the situation towards monetary freedom?
Well, first of all, we need to get rid of the Federal Reserve. I mean, that's the central bank. That's the central problem. And we need to get rid of these Federal Reserve notes, this paper money that represents no tangible value in the economy. And so first thing is get rid of the Fed. We also need to get rid of Federal Deposit Insurance, which makes the bad behavior of individual banks, makes the taxpayer basically responsible for all that. And, you know, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, is now out of money. And so any banks that are going to be cured by the FDIC is going to come out of our paychecks in order to pay for that. So we need to get rid of that.
Right.
And then there's a lot of individual things that can be done as well, like getting rid of legal tender laws, allowing competing currencies like gold and silver coins compete with Federal Reserve notes without having to pay capital gains taxes and sales taxes and all the rest. So there's a lot of things that we can do that will drive us in the direction of freedom and stable and sound money. And,
well, I want to go over these steps a little bit more in detail, and I also want to go over some of the steps that you say we should not do, things that we do not want. But we have another caller. We have Chris from calling in right now. Chris, are you on the line?
Yes, sir.
Okay, please. What is your
question? I have just a couple of things.
Chris,
paper money is
hold on to us. Hold on with us, Chris. We're going to have to take a break. And so
okay. We're
going to have to connect you back in after we get back. Folks, this is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. Please stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. And today we are talking with Dr. Mark Thornton, and we're talking about monetary freedom and its opposite. And we basically had a caller in from Canada, Chris, on the line with us.
Yes.
Okay. So we weren't able to get to your question. Chris, what is your question there?
To deal with paper money, basically the way I see it, the way I understand it, it's all it is now is considered a promissory note. That being said, I feel the doctor would probably agree with that, my assessment of it. And there was another caller earlier that had to do with the evil government. And what I find with that is it's not the evil government. It's the individuals behind the scenes that create our evil government that are causing these issues. The Rockefellers, the Rothschilds. These are the guys I think we got to look for. When we did have an actual currency, or actually in the United States, when you had an actual currency that was still considered somewhat legit, it was called a greenback, was it not, by Kennedy? And there's just on a footnote here, if you want to watch a good video here in Canada of what happened to our slide with our dollar, there's a good video out there. Retired history teacher, his name is Bill Abram. He has three 10-minute short expos on the currency, what we used to have and where we're going now with it.
Very good. Well,
and
thank you very
good.
Much, Chris.
Yes,
I'm going to turn this over to Mark.
Yes, Chris, our paper money is a promissory note from the Federal Reserve, but all that promissory note entitles you to is a clean copy or a brand new copy of that same Federal Reserve note. So it's a promise to pay, but it's not much of a promise. It's another one of these tricks. And, you know, you bring up individuals within the system, and yes, that definitely is an issue, but those individuals change over time, but the system itself is what we're talking about here, how it actually extracts revenues from individual citizens without them knowing it. And so that's really the purpose of here is not who's taking our money, but how they're doing it. And that's basically
now,
what we're getting at.
Before Chris came on, we had, Mark, you outlined several steps on the path of monetary freedom, and I want to review those. We have a nice long segment right now. We have about 18 minutes that we can talk about this before our next break. But before we get into these positive steps, I want to spend just a couple of minutes and ask you to outline, Mark, what are some of the reforms that you hear about that we don't want, that will not work?
Well, there's a lot of them that we've already experienced in the past, where, for example, the government will target the price of gold versus the dollar within a certain range, or with the old Bretton Woods systems where the countries agreed to exchange their currencies at a set value and set that value to gold. There's the old gold exchange standard system where government holds the gold and emits paper notes into the economy. The problem with this, these type of approaches is it leaves all the power and authority within the hands of government.
Mm-hmm.
They have all the gold. They have all the knowledge about how much gold and how much paper are in existence, and so there's no constraint on them to keep gold and paper balanced. And so inevitably, they start emitting too much paper. And when they emit that paper, they either threaten the viability of the currency, they start to cause a business cycle, they start to cause inflation. So in an ideal world, sure, we could have an ideal government, you know, balance paper and gold and that sort of thing. But the reality is that we don't live in an ideal world. We don't have idealistic politicians and bureaucrats that are omniscient and know how to keep all these systems going. So we want to remove government from the process entirely. Mm-hmm. We want individuals, all individuals, to have the constraint to say, yes, I will accept your money, or no, I will not accept your money. And we have the freedom to do that. Right now, and along with all of these old reforms and suggested new reforms, they keep all the power within government, and they don't give people the power to impose a constraint upon the government's monetary system. So we don't want a government monetary system. We don't want a government standard. We want freedom, just like we want freedom in apples, in shoes, in dresses, in automobiles. That's what we want because that's what benefits consumers. That's what benefits individuals. That's what creates jobs. And there's no coercion involved.
So, you know, I was very impressed by this list that you put in your essay that I, again, recommend everybody to read. You mentioned that we don't want a Bretton Woods system. You don't want a gold exchange standard. We don't want even a gold standard at all that is government imposed. And we don't want Federal Reserve notes. And we have no, in fact, we want no government control over the money and no FDIC. One of the, in fact, the common thread through all of these different routes that you're suggesting is the elimination of some centralized control over money and a return of money being a true market-based phenomenon.
That's correct. You know, most people will be of the belief that money is too important to be left to the economy and has to be in the hands of government. My view is that money is too important to be left in the hands of government. It has to be in the economy where people actually have control over the money.
Well, if we took that logic to the next step of the people who think that money should be controlled by government, well then, you know, food should be controlled by government. Clothing should be controlled by government. I mean, we all have to have clothing. We all need to have food. And yet we find that the market supplies us those just fine. And so why would they think that money would be different?
That's right. No one would put up with the idea of government actually building automobiles or government in charge of restaurants or government in charge of what books should be produced.
Or read,
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So these are common sense notions that are shared by most Americans.
Well, one of these suggestions that you made had to do with the FDIC. And you make a comment here, why does deposit insurance create moral hazard? And this is my question. I have a second question also, but what is moral hazard? Anyway, can you describe that to our listeners?
Well, yes, moral hazard is an economic situation in which the incentives come out of balance with one another and gives people the incentive to do the wrong thing. Health insurance is actually a case where you have a moral hazard. If you have comprehensive health care where anything that could possibly go wrong with your health would be paid for by the government or would be paid for by an insurance plan, people don't have the incentive to have good health, and so they become overweight, they smoke, they drink, they don't get enough rest and exercise and so forth. You know, and so if we gave people that kind of car insurance, we would see more accidents because everything would be covered. And so with the FDIC, the FDIC provides insurance for our bank deposits so that we don't have to really monitor where we deposit our money because we know it's going to be protected by the government no matter where we deposit it.
It lulls us into a false sense of security.
Exactly, a false sense of security. And it also allows banks, because we're not imposing constraints on the banks of picking and choosing where we want to safely deposit our money, then banks can become riskier and they can lend their money out without feeling the pinch of the consumer looking over their shoulder. And so this is exactly what we've seen, of course, is banks all over the country have been making loans willy-nilly, giving away loans and mortgages to projects that were much too risky and much more likely to be foreclosed and go bankrupt, because consumers were not overlooking the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And being concerned, actually, what's happened in the last couple of years is that consumers are actually out looking for banks that are going to probably go bankrupt because they're offering the highest interest rates on certificates of deposit. So consumers are actually out looking for the riskiest banks offering the highest interest rate, knowing that the FDIC and you and I and the taxpayer are going to pick up the tab.
Right,
this is just insanity.
Well, you know, this concept of moral hazard is very important. Point. We want to bring this out a little bit more. There was a news article that came out in the last couple of days about free golf carts. Apparently the IRS ruled that golf carts can qualify for an electric car credit, which is a manipulation of the tax code. And at the foundational problem of this issue of moral hazard is this concept of trying to get something for nothing, or that there's a sense of entitlement. I want to read to you a quote. There was a golf cart dealer in Florida. His name is Mr. Tony Colangelo in Florida, and he's advertising these free carts. And his quote that appeared in John Stossel's blog is that he thinks this is good for the average person. As he says, "I never in my entire life got anything back from the government, and I've always paid taxes. Why shouldn't the people who worked hard for their money get something back?" But what he forgot is the three other words, "from other people."
Right.
And so this is really the example of what, you know, moral hazard really, it turns us into kind of a parasitic society, whereas instead of us trying to carry our own weight, we justify these quote-unquote gifts from government because, you know, otherwise, how can we, you know, not take advantage of them? People feel somewhat compelled to take advantage of these opportunities when they come along. By the way, they're dubbing this debacle "cash for clubbers" as opposed to cash for clunkers.
Yeah, but it's the same nonsense to begin with. I mean, what does this nation really need? Another a million golf carts out there? Is that really going to be the thing that saves us, or the cash for clunkers deal where we're basically encouraging people to buy brand new cars and take on more debt, and then take the cars that have been traded in, which in many cases were perfectly viable means of transportation, and destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
So we're destroying viable goods and services for that temporary, fleeting sense of success in that more people are walking through car dealers and buying more cars in exchange for destroying other cars.
Okay.
So this kind of economic nonsense is never going to get us out of this economic crisis and back on the road to prosperity. It's just quite the contrary.
Let's talk about the list of things that we do want. You know, like you mentioned with the list that you mentioned earlier, market-based money, and I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that and also repeal of legal tender laws. Let's go to that market-based money topic. In your essay, you talk about silver and silver and gold coins, and an obvious question that people are going to have is, could they still use checks and debit cards and credit cards? How would that work?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, when you have a gold, silver, copper coins in circulation, that doesn't foreclose the idea where you can use debit cards, credit cards, checks, and so forth. There would be no problem with that at all, especially in this day and age when you could easily convert your debit card, which is denominated in ounces of gold, into dollars and cents. Okay, so there would be no problem whatsoever in terms of facilitating transactions or using electronic means of payment or paper means of payment. You know, so there's no technical reason why we can't use gold and silver and use them electronically and use them interchangeably with what are, you know, the paper dollar.
So there is a practical way in which this can work. And you mentioned that one of the other things that we really need is the repeal of legal tender laws. Could you explain what legal tender laws are?
Well, it's just a decree by the government which says that you are required to use those Federal Reserve notes or those paper dollars for all debts, public and private. Now, public debts are your taxes.
That's what it says on the dollar bills.
That's right. Yeah, so they're not hiding that one on you at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you went into the store, you are not actually required to accept, you know, say 10,000 pennies for a you know, a few bags of groceries. It doesn't go down to that level.
Mm-hmm.
But any debts that you've incurred, such as a mortgage or a car payment or a commercial loan or anything along those lines, and then, of course, any taxes. So all of the big money decisions, you're required to use these paper Federal Reserve note dollars, and that gives paper Reserve note dollars a total competitive advantage over other forms of money.
Because it's basically a monopoly on money.
That's right. And to make matters worse, of course, if you bought some gold coins and then tried to make an exchange, say, with them a year later and they had appreciated in value, well, then you're talking about capital gains tax and sales tax on gold and silver coins because they're not considered money by the U.S. government. They're considered just a product, and so they're subject to capital gains and sales tax, which gives the Federal Reserve notes an even greater monopoly position over metal forms of money.
So in practical terms, some of the things that we really do want to have happen is, first, we want to eliminate this monopoly over money, and second, allow other monies to compete. But could we still have a Federal Reserve and fractional reserve notes and other competing monies? Is that possible?
Well, it certainly is possible, and it would be highly desirable. I mean, if the Fed didn't have legal tender laws backing it, if it didn't have, you know, capital gains and sales tax on gold, then gold and silver would be a form of money, and the Federal Reserve would have to compete against them. And if they tried to inflate the supply of paper notes, what that would mean is that the paper notes would decline in value, and the gold would increase in value, so they couldn't inflate.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back to this topic in just a second. We're talking with Dr. Mark Thornton on monetary freedom and its opposite. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And please stay with us. We'll be back right after the break.
Okay.
And we're back. Folks, this is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and this is our final segment with Dr. Mark Thornton, and we're talking about monetary freedom and its opposite. And Zoe, you had a question that you wanted to ask, Doctor.
Dr. Thornton, could you summarize what we ultimately need to see in order to achieve monetary freedom?
Sure, Zoe. Basically, what we have is a very corrupt and bankrupt system right now, and it needs to be totally displaced. So we need to bring the Federal Reserve to an end. And there's a lot of to do about this, but basically what we would do is take the Federal Reserve assets, its gold holdings, and sell them into the economy, taking those Federal Reserve notes that we get, basically disposing of them. And, you know, and then also the Federal Reserve has a lot of government debt, but the government owns it, so we can just simply destroy all of that as well.
Would this be like any other bankruptcy proceeding?
Well, it certainly could be. You know, basically that's what we need to do is to go in there, look at its books, and take its assets and sell off as many assets as possible to redeem the liabilities, and then sell off all the physical assets in order to meet the remaining liabilities as best as possible, and then just bring the system to the end. That would put all of the gold out in the hands of the general public, and it would greatly reduce or eliminate all the Federal Reserve notes out there. There are functions of the Fed that can be done privately, so that's not a problem either.
How does the debt just disappear?
Well, the Federal Reserve has hundreds of billions of dollars of government debt, and that's its asset. That's where it gets interest on that, and in order to pay its expenses. Well, if it's not going to have any expenses, it doesn't need that government debt. And so that can just be eliminated right off the top. And so that would, you know, in the past that would have been a big chunk of the government debt. Today it's a much smaller chunk, but still, nonetheless, it does two good things. It gets the Federal Reserve out of the economy, and it reduces the national debt. So we take all this national debt, and we take all these paper notes that we've gathered from selling all of the government's gold, and we celebrate with a giant bonfire of government paper.
So, Mark, what would be some of the other results of greater monetary freedom?
Well, there'd be a lot more stability in society. Monetary freedom with gold and silver coins means that you're not going to get inflation of prices. It means that prices in the economy will decline over time, and so your wages, even if your wage rate stayed the same, you'd have greater purchasing power over time. So you'd get greater prosperity. You eliminate the business cycle because the Fed doesn't have the ability to manipulate. And actually, it's actually great for the cause of peace, too, because central banks allow governments to finance war by inflation and by debt. And so if we can take that power away from government, we take away their ability to wage irrational international wars.
Or even empire building.
And empire building, of course, the United States has the eminent position in money. We have the world's reserve currency, and we have this loose-knit worldwide empire of, you know, of possessions and of allies, and that could no longer be sustained. We couldn't manipulate other countries because we wouldn't have the money to do it.
Well, folks, we're coming to the end of our show. I'm going to end with this quote by Ludwig von Mises that he wrote, that the era of inflation will come to an end once people realize that the process of inflation is ongoing with no end in sight. Please educate yourself further, folks. Come to our website, radiofreemarket.com, and also Mises.org. This is Michael McKay. Until next week, please join us again on our show, Radio Free Market.